So, for those of you who don't know me, my name is Greg. I don't usually attend on Tuesday nights. It's kind of hard for me to get here on Tuesday, so I'm more of a regular fixture on Sundays. I've seen all of you who are only there on Tuesdays because I watch these videos every Wednesday or Thursday. So it's nice to see you all in real time, if not in real life. I took Jukai last year, so I've only really been doing this for 1 year. I've only had the precepts at the forefront of my mind for that 1 year. I practiced them for quite a while beforehand. I've been practicing Zen for maybe 3 years, and the precepts were always something of interest to me and kind of part of what attracted me to the practice in the first place. I needed some sort of moral compass, I guess, for lack of a better term. And that seemed like a good one to go with. I couldn't decide if I should write this down or kind of speak more extemporaneously. So I made this outline, which is just like, I don't know, it's longer than if I had written it down word for word. So we'll see how this goes. We've got about 53 minutes to go. If it looks like I'm like a half hour over time, please somebody wave to me and I'll shut up and get on with it, let you get on with your night. That's part of the reason I don't normally meet up on Tuesdays. I'm usually pretty out of it by this time of the day after work and everything. So Sundays tend to work better for me. But and that was why I was excited too when the email came out asking for people who had taken Jukai to volunteer to do these talks came out, because I had an easy excuse right away. I don't come on Tuesdays, so I don't have to give a talk. But a couple of days after the email came out, I just kept thinking about it and felt like I was breaking this very precept that I'm going to talk about tonight, the 10th precept, by not volunteering to do this talk. So I just kind of had to do it. I feel like I owe it to all of you to put myself aside and my anxieties and my fear, and just kind of go ahead and do this. So hopefully you get something out of it. I put a lot into it, I don't know if what I put in will come out and for all of you, but I hope some of it does at least. So this is the last talk before Jukai. We're going to talk about the 10th precept, honoring the Buddha, the Dharma, and the Sangha. I usually do better listening to a presentation if the speaker kind of tells me kind of what to expect. So I'm going to do a little quick overview to start. So we'll talk about the precept itself, the 10th precept, talking about how you honor or how you dishonor the Buddha, the Dharma, and the Sangha. Then I want to talk a little bit about what it looks like more in general to follow the precepts, since it's our last chance for everyone to talk together before 14 of you go ahead and take the precepts and the rest of us kind of renew our vows with those precepts. So what it looks like just to follow the precepts in general, what it feels like when you like bump up against a precept, and like how to know when you are about to break or being encountered by a precept, and kind of what to do in that situation. And then why even bother to take the precepts? Like, nobody has to. Don't be upset it on Sunday. You can practice Zen your whole life and never take the precepts. But in my opinion, I think it's really a valuable rite of passage, I guess, and useful to our practice in general. And it's like I said, it's only been a year for me, but it's been a really good year. Things have really looked a lot different to me this year than they have the previous 46 years. So it's, I think it's worth doing. If you're not one of the 14 that are planning to take it next week, then I hope it's something you plan to do someday. As again, it's your prerogative, but I found it to be a really worthwhile thing to do. All right, so the 10th precept, we're coming full circle here. We started off by taking refuge in the Buddha, the Dharma, and the Sangha, and now we're being reminded that those three things were there to give us refuge, and so we owe them a little bit of respect. The precept is in the negative, not do not defame the Buddha, the Dharma, or the Sangha, and in the positive, it's to honor or esteem or revere the Buddha, the Sangha, and the Dharma. So I'm going to start off just by reading a couple of different people's explanations of this precept. Just three different versions of it, I guess. Starting off with John Dido Laurie from his book, The Heart of Being. which is a really good book for people who are studying the precepts. This is probably my favorite of the ones that I've read. So he says the 10th grade precept, the way he states the precept itself is, experience the intimacy of things. Do not defile the three treasures. And then he describes this by saying, the one mind precept says self-nature is inconceivably wondrous. In the one Dharma, not giving rise to the dualistic view of sentient beings and Buddhas, is called the precept of refraining from reviling the three treasures. To give rise to the thought, I'm just an ordinary person, reviles and defiles the three treasures and breaks this precept. There are only Buddhas. We tend to build dreams of separateness that eventually become nightmares of alienation and isolation. And then we struggle and awaken from the nightmare we have created. To practice this precept is to wake up. There are only Buddhas. The Buddha nature is inconceivably wondrous. Not an atom is left out. Not a particle is outside of it. Because there is no outside, there is no inside. Therefore, there is no way to defile it. The 10th precept closes the loop. The 16 precepts start off with the three treasures and end with the three treasures. So that's one. Next, I have a book called Serene Reflection Meditation. This is from Shasta Abbey. Reverend Master Geo Kennett wrote this book. Well, there are a lot of different articles in here written by different people, but she wrote this commentary to the Kyoju Kaiman, and I'm going to read this from. So it says, do not defame the three treasures. To do something by ourselves without copying others, this is repeated in our chant book, which I'll read next. To do something by ourselves without copying others is to become an example to the world, and the merit of doing such a thing becomes the source of all wisdom. Do not criticize, but accept everything. That's, I think, kind of the best summation of all these different versions of this, is to not criticize, but to accept everything. I'm going to talk a lot about that. Geo Kennett talks about the lord of the house a lot, which was kind of off-putting to me at first, until I realized what she means by the lord of the house is the Buddha nature, essentially. That's just her way of putting it. She comes from an Anglican Christian background, and the phraseology she uses often kind of refers back to that, which I think is a great approach that some people can relate to. So anyway, the lord of the house, or the Buddha nature, does not always do things in the normally accepted ways, nor do the Buddhas and ancestors. They are not individual, and they are not the same as each other. Each expresses the truth in his own way, as do all things. They do that which they do in their way and express the lord or the Buddha nature within it. Do not criticize the way of another, and do not call it into question. Look within it and see the Lord. Look with the mind of a Buddha, and you will see with the heart of a Buddha. To criticize is to defame the Lord of the house. Love the Lord of the house at all times. Know him, talk to him. Never let a day go by when you do not consult with him, even on the slightest matter. Then you will never, as long as you live, defame the three treasures. And finally, from our chant book, do not defame the three treasures. In the realm of the one, holding no concept of ordinary beings and sages is the precept of not defaming the three treasures. To do something by ourselves without copying others, we just heard this, is to become an example to the world, and the merit of this becomes the source of all wisdom. Criticize nothing, accept everything. Again, I think that last statement is the best way to sum this all up. We're talking about three things: the Buddha, the Dharma, and the Sangha. But they're really one thing. They're everything. They're all of this. So I'll talk more about that statement in a moment. But to follow the one precept, we're honoring three things, but we're also honoring everything as if it's one thing. So many of us, if not all of us, come to this practice looking for relief from suffering. And we're told, fine, come on in. You can take refuge here with the Buddha, the Dharma, the Sangha. So what right would we have to then go on to criticize or take for granted or even ignore those very treasures that offered us refuge when we needed it the most? So to honor this precept, we're all here as a Sangha to welcome anyone who comes to us looking for refuge. We'd be breaking this precept if we weren't there, to offer that to them, and to not criticize them or to criticize the the practice itself in front of them in a way that's going to turn them off to it. Like, we're not here to proselytize or to be evangelical Buddhists or anything like that, but we are here to be welcoming and friendly, and to share this Dharma with anybody who can benefit from it. That's the whole point of all of these precepts. These are ways of expressing the Bodhisattva vow. We take this vow to liberate all beings before ourselves. So we don't follow the precepts for us, we follow it for everyone else before us. So let's talk a little bit about what it looks like when this precept is being honored and when it's being broken. We'll go through each jewel or treasure individually, though I do think it can be beneficial to think of them as one thing, as this precept is a singular thing, to simply honor the three treasures. Even though it helps to look at the three treasures one by one, let's just remember that they are not three distinct things. They are every one and they are everything. What's that movie called, Everything, Everywhere, All at Once? Simply put, that's what it means to revere the three treasures. It means to honor everything, everywhere, all at once. At this moment, at this next moment, at this moment here, to constantly be in reverence to the beauty that we've been given as this gift. This life is a gift to us. And we can either spend our time enjoying that gift and playing with it and spending every moment thanking and being thankful and happy that we have this gift, or we can criticize it and be frustrated and annoyed and have our bad days and let the bad things that bring us down even further. But to honor our life and to just be there and be present with it, I think is honoring this precept. So honoring the Buddha. So this means the historical Buddha, obviously, but also the Buddha within all of us, the Buddha nature, the Lord of the house, as Reverend Master Gio Kennett calls it. So how do we honor the Buddha within and the historical figure of the Buddha? We can do it simultaneously with Sampai. So on Sundays, I thought you guys did it tonight too, which is why I brought it up. I was going to refer to it. But on Sunday, for those of you who don't attend on Sundays regularly, we do three full bows where we use our whole body to prostrate ourselves before the statue of the Buddha in the Dharma Hall and any images of the Buddha that we have here in our homes for those of us in the cloud. And we use our full body to do that. Our arms, our legs, every part of our outer body. But the one thing that I often forget is that we should be using our hearts and our minds when we're doing Sampai too. A full bow is not just your full body, but it's fully mindful and it's fully wholehearted. And any of these forms that we practice in Zen, if we do them wholeheartedly, then I think we're honoring this 10th precept. We're honoring the Buddha by wholeheartedly engaging with the forms that we practice. The image I have of the Buddha over there on the other side of my room doesn't care if I bow to it with my whole heart or my whole mind. It makes no difference. But my practice improves when I do that, when I do it wholeheartedly. When I'm able to humble myself before a picture that's hanging on my wall, I'm able to go out later in the day, and when I encounter someone who I'm bumping heads with and don't see eye to eye with and don't agree with and would normally get into a fight with a year ago before I took these precepts, maybe 3 years ago before I started meditating, I began into a lot of fights out there and arguments, just annoyed with everybody. But when I'm able to humble myself and prostrate myself wholeheartedly in front of this image, when I go out and encounter those same people, I can be humble around them too. And my pride doesn't get in the way. My understanding of how the world's supposed to be doesn't get in the way of my ability to just be present with a human who I don't necessarily agree with. So that's powerful. I mean, like, just bowing to a picture, like, I had a hard time with that too, just like the whole Lord of the House business. I took Jukai at Shasta Abbey before I came here. I'm very well acquainted with Shasta Abbey, and I really love going there. It's one of my favorite places. I've done maybe four sesshin so far, and they've all been there at Shasta Abbey. And some of their terminology is weird to me, like the Lord of the House thing, and then the bowing. Like, I was raised Catholic. I went to Catholic school. I was an altar boy. Like, all this stuff was stuff that I had put behind me and I didn't find useful. So to come back to some of these forms now was very unusual and hard for me. But when I realized that when I'm bowing in front of that picture, I'm bowing to the Buddha nature that unites all of us, I'm bowing to the Buddha nature that brings the good into the world. I'm bowing to this ideal of us all being liberated together, and not to some image of a man who came up with the Four Noble Truths and the Eightfold Path, who's an honorable person who I do feel humble before, but it's so much more than that. Like, there are only Buddhas. I read that from John Dido Laurie, there are only Buddhas. We all have a Buddha nature within us. And that's what I feel I'm bowing to, at least when I do Sampai. So wholehearted practice is one way to honor the Buddha and honor the 10th precept. We honor the Buddha by acknowledging that the Buddha is always present in every aspect of our daily lives, and we behave accordingly. By taking this practice seriously, by following the form simply because we're told to, because we have the faith that if we do this, all beings will be liberated. Of course, take the time to verify the truth of this practice, but then let go of control and watch where it takes us to have faith in this practice. For me, it's kind of like the scientific method. Like, I don't know why the COVID vaccine works. I don't know if it does, but I have faith in the scientific method, so I let them give me the shot. I feel the same way about these forms. I don't know if bowing before, wholeheartedly before a picture that's hanging on my wall is going to save the entire universe, but it'd be pretty cool if it did, so why not do it? So how do we break this precept with respect to the Buddha? How do we disrespect the Buddha? We do disrespect the Buddha just by going through the motions in our practice and in our lives in general, by not being present in our lives or our practice, by just kind of like going through life half asleep. That's how we dishonor the Buddha. By failing to recognize that the Buddha nature is in everyone, even the people we can't stand, even the people who rub us completely the wrong way, the people that we feel are destroying the world or the planet or the country or whatever. Recognize that there's something inside them that's the same as you are. By failing to see everything as a unit that's connected by this Buddha nature, like this is one thing that we're all a part of. It's just one thing. And to start finding distinctions between things starts to put the duality into things and makes us start to have to make decisions about this is good, this is bad, this is good, this is bad. And once we do that, then we've slipped away from our Buddha nature of seeing us all as united in one. We break it by putting off our lives, by putting off our practice, by dismissing the precepts or other forms because they're inconvenient or uncomfortable, or we just don't feel like it. That's one that gets me a lot of the time too, the most, is I can avoid breaking this precept, but it'd be so much easier just to break it and get on with what I have to do next. So the Dharma. So the Dharmas are the teachings, obviously, the sutras, the books we read, the Dharma talks we listen to, the conversations we have with our friends, our Zen friends about Buddhism. But it's also everything. Like, everything is a Dharma gate. Like, I can knock my book off the table and perhaps become enlightened, or my phone will break and I'll have a really rotten day because, like, I don't have my phone, my little crutch that I carry around with me everywhere to solve all my problems for me. Or I'll get in a fight with my wife, or someone smashed my windshield a week ago. It turned out it was like a hit and run on a scooter and they flipped over the handlebars and hit the windshield, but that was still a hassle. But that's a Dharma gate too, because I never got pissed off. Like, I'm an angry guy. Like, the 9th precept is my precept. That's what brought me to this practice. And I get so angry about everything. And like, I walked out, I saw my windshield smash and I shrugged my shoulders, laughed, called an Uber to get where I was going and dealt with it later. Like, that would not have happened 4 years ago. There's no way. It would have been the end of my day. I would have had all kinds of problems. I would have finished the job. I would have broken every window on that car, which wouldn't have got me anywhere, but just a little bit of like anger high, which I tend to get off on for some reason. So the Dharma is everywhere. It's a broken windshield. It can be the Four Noble Truths, or it can be a broken phone. It can be the Eightfold Path, Or it can be a flat tire. It's everywhere. It's everything. It's everything, everywhere, all at once. So when we follow the precept of honoring the Dharma, we do so by reading and listening to the sutras and the teachings without reading self-serving interpretations into them. This is what I think this means, because it's convenient for me, for right speech to mean I can yell at this guy that I can't stand because he's also a jerk to other people, so I can be a jerk to him. That's finding self-serving interpretations. By taking the teachings to heart, we're honoring the Dharma. By slowing down and listening and paying attention, even if we're tired or had a bad day or have something better coming up later. By looking for Dharma gates and walking through them rather than avoiding them, because they are painful or upsetting or difficult, because indeed these types of Dharma gates lead to the most profound realizations. By paying attention to the Dharma of our everyday life, by asking ourselves, where do these teachings interact with my life? How can I apply these teachings to my human experience? And how can I use these teachings to make the world a better place? How can I use them to liberate all sentient beings? We break this part of the precept when we criticize something we read or hear in a Dharma talk, assuming the other person who's giving the talk is wrong, rather than examining why we might not be seeing the subject the way that they are. By going too far in the other direction too, and taking everything they say to heart without actually verifying any of it ourselves, we're still breaking this precept. We're hurting ourselves by just taking everything anyone says to us about this practice 100% to heart without ever trying to see if that's actually going to work for us in our lives. If we keep doing this practice and it doesn't help us, then we're wasting our lives and we're breaking this precept. So we need to, if we're doing this practice and it's not working for us, we need to either figure out how to make it work or look for another one, and that's fine. The point of life is to live it, not to follow 10 precepts or 16 precepts, unless they make your life better and help you to make the lives of everyone around you better. So Sangha obviously is all of us. It's everyone we know. It's everyone in our country, our planet, our universe, all the living things, all the unliving things, everything around us, everything everywhere, all at once. It's everyone. So the Lotus Sutra says, only a Buddha with another Buddha can realize the truth of all things. So when we follow the precept of honoring Sangha, we do so when we take advantage of volunteer opportunities. I didn't want to give this talk. I had to give this talk. I'm really not having the time of my life in this moment, but I feel like this is the thing that I'm here to do. Some of you may not understand or relate at least to anything that I'm saying, but maybe one of you will. And for that, I owe it to all of you to just be here and give this talk the best I can. When we provide a field of refuge in the same way this refuge was extended to us, when we don't distinguish between good and bad people, since all of us has a Buddha nature. And so I have another thing I'm gonna read to you here from Pema Chodron's Things Fall Apart, page 92. So she mentions bodhicitta here. I think everybody's kind of familiar with bodhicitta, but I'll just define it now instead of when I get to that, in case of, just so I don't interrupt the flow, I guess. But if you're not familiar with bodhicitta, that's kind of what drives us to do this practice. It's what drives us to say the bodhisattva vow and believe it. Pema Chodron calls it our soft spot. It's the part of us that wants to liberate all beings before ourselves. It's that compassionate part of us that wants to follow these precepts that has us all here tonight. So here's what she says about what I think relates the most to honoring the Sangha practice, the Sangha treasure. She says, spiritual awakening is frequently described as a journey to the top of the mountain. We leave our attachments and our worldliness behind and slowly make our way to the top. At the peak, we have transcended all pain. The only problem with this metaphor is that we leave all of the others behind. Our drunken brother. This part of the book always gets me, sorry. Our schizophrenic sister, our tormented animals and friends, their suffering continues unrelieved by our personal escape. In the process of discovering bodhicitta, the journey goes down, not up. It's as if the mountain pointed toward the center of the earth instead of reaching into the sky. Instead of transcending the suffering of all creatures, we move toward the turbulence and doubt. We jump into it. We slide into it. We tiptoe into it. We move toward it however we can. We explore the reality and unpredictability of insecurity and pain, and we try not to push it away. It takes years. It takes lifetimes. We let it be as it is. At our own pace, without speed or aggression, we move down and down and down. With us moves millions of others, our companions in awakening from fear. At the bottom, we discover water, the healing water of bodhicitta. Right down there in the thick of things, we discover the love that will not die. So that's honoring the Song of the Treasure. That's when we go down the mountain. We can go up to the mountain and read our books and sit on our cushions, but none of that matters until we get off the mountain. We can go to Sesshin and be alone with the monks and the wall, but it's not until we leave the monastery that any of this really matters. So coming down off the mountain, that's how you honor the Song of Treasure. We break it by creating in-groups and out-groups, by putting ourselves before our practice, by gossiping about others. I don't know if this is anybody else, but this is me to a T, by always having one person in every group that you just don't like, for no reason, just other than you just have to have an enemy, I guess. By using the moral high ground to exclude others, which is an oxymoron. We're all interdependent, and each one of us brings something to the group, even if it seems like everything about the other person is antithetical to everything that we believe in. So here it's helpful for me to picture Marjorie Taylor Greene. And I don't want to get too political or offend anyone who's a supporter of her politics. This isn't about her politics, really. It's about her demeanor. She just seems like somebody who needs a hug to me. And she gets very angry. But what I think makes her so angry, I can relate to this, is that she just cares so much about what she believes in that it drives her to a point where she's pushing people away from her. Even her own party, if you've been following the news lately, her own party has even sort of turned their backs on her at this point. And she's an extremely passionate person who I don't agree with politically, but who I feel deeply for personally. And I think coming down off the mountain would be giving Marjorie Taylor Greene a hug for me, would be being able to put all my stuff aside, all of my feelings aside, and just to say, like, I can tell you're hurting and I want to help. And I don't agree with anything you believe in, but I want to help you anyway. I think that it would be following the honoring of the Sangha treasure. All right. So the last thing I have about the 10th precept, and then I'll try to talk a little bit about the precepts in general for a few minutes before we open it up to the group. Here's something from How to Cook Your Life. This is Kosho Chiyama's commentary on the Dogen's instructions to the cook. So he says, in the same way that a roshin is the mind or attitude of a parent, in the same way that a parent cares for an only child, keep the three treasures in your mind. A parent, irrespective of poverty or difficult circumstances, loves and raises a child with care. How deep is love like this? Only a parent can understand it. A parent protects the children from the cold shades, from the cold, and shades them from the hot sun with no concern for his or her own personal welfare. Only a person in whom this mind has arisen can understand it, and only one in whom this attitude has become second nature can fully realize it. So I don't have kids, but I feel like I can relate to unconditional love, which I think is what he's talking about there. I think unconditional love is the way that you honor the Sangha treasure. We don't have to agree with each other to love each other. We don't have to believe what everyone's telling us to love them. I think we just need to be there for them. And that's how we bring everyone to liberation before ourselves. If we're able to say, I don't agree with you, but I love you anyway, like a parent would to a child who they don't agree with. Like, I don't know, what if Marjorie Taylor Greene was your daughter? Like, you'd probably give her a lot of hugs. I would. I think she needs them. So that's all I have to say about the 10th precept. We've got 14 minutes. I'm going to try to go through the rest of this fast. So what does it look like to follow the precepts? I think it's important to remember that the precepts are descriptive, not prescriptive. These aren't commandments that are telling us what we should and should not do. They're descriptions of what the Buddha nature does in its element. So it's my belief that when your Buddha nature is shining through the cracks in yourself, you're able to witness the precepts being honored in the world around you. You alone are not following the precepts. The causes and conditions of existence are creating these circumstances where precepts are or are not being executed. You're not doing this for yourself, and you're not even doing it. There's so many things that are causing our behavior that are so far beyond our control that we can't break or follow a precept. We can try, and it's useful for us to try. I think the point of this is to just keep trying harder. The point of the precepts is to say, you're making a vow, so it's worthwhile to try to put good karma out there instead of bad karma out there. But really, we have so little control in this universe. We think we have so much more control than we do, but really, like, everything's just happening all around us so fast that we can't even keep up. So if we can just do our best to, when we have the opportunity to do a good thing rather than a bad thing, hopefully, like, everything else will be more good and less bad. And that's all. I think that's all that's expected of us with these precepts that I've heard. I've been watching the videos and I've from the other talks from the series, and some people have been talking about how they didn't want to take Jukai because they didn't think they could follow the precepts. But I just want to point out that none of us can follow these precepts. All of us who have taken Jukai, I took it a year ago. Some of you maybe have taken it 20 years ago. And I think none of us is following these precepts all the time. We take all these impossible vows in Zen. And the point of them is just to try harder. Beings are numberless. I vow to free them. Delusions are inexhaustible. I vow to end them. Dharma gates are endless. I vow to enter them. This is literally impossible. We can't do any of this stuff. But by taking that vow, we're just telling ourselves that we're going to try a little harder to just do right by the world and by ourselves. And in doing so, then we're going to make things better for the people around us. So as John Dido Laurie put it in the passage I quoted earlier, there are only Buddhas. We're there's a Buddha nature working here. So we have to give ourselves over to it and let it do what it does. We have these selves that kind of get in the way of our intuition, but if we simply follow our intuition, then it's likely that we're following our precepts. Because we don't, when we follow our intuition, this bag of bones that is shaped around that Buddha nature just gets in its way, or doesn't get in its way. But as soon as we start getting ourselves involved, then we start breaking precepts, and it becomes hard to undo what we've already done. So as Chiyu Kennett says, and where I quoted before, to do something by ourselves without copying others is to become an example to the world, and the merit of this becomes the source of all wisdom. So if we don't copy others, if we do something truly by ourselves, if we just let our Buddha nature shine through, then we're kind of honoring these precepts, all of the precepts, all 16 of these precepts. The Buddha, the Dharma, and the Sangha are everything. Therefore, anytime we criticize anything, we're criticizing the three treasures and robbing ourselves of the opportunity to experience things as they are rather than things as we want them to be. Isn't mystery so much more fascinating than the world you want, wish for, or expect? So just throwing ourselves into it, letting our intuition take over, failing to criticize, just accept whatever comes to us. I accept the broken windshields of your lives. And just let them happen. And I mean, like, I had so much fun. Like, when that windshield was smashed, my wife and I, like, were detectives. We figured out exactly what happened because I just walked out and my window was smashed, but we found the scooter that the person was riding and smashed into my car with, like, around the corner. And we confirmed it, like, forensically. We matched up the paint and everything. Like, we had a great time. It was a really fun night. Like, I could have been so pissed off about that, but instead, I just had a fun night with my wife, and it cost less than an insurance deductible. It was no big deal. So by failing to criticize and just accepting what had happened, I had a pretty good night. That doesn't, things don't always work out that way for me. But that night was a good one. So what happens when you bump up against one of these precepts? I have a koan here I want to read that I think kind of illustrates one of those moments where you're just face to face with a precept and you don't know what to do. So I think everyone knows what a koan is. I'll explain it just in case to the best of my ability. We can, with the Dharma can explain things explicitly to us and tell us what this or that is within our practice, or they can give us these koans that kind of just point vaguely at the truth. And because words can't really capture what the truth is for any of this. So these koans are like thought experiments, but they're also just kind of like a general like pointing at the moon, a finger pointing at the moon. It doesn't give you the answer. It just kind of nudges you. So this one's called Kyogen Mounts the Tree. So I know we have a Kyogen in our lineage. Dommi's teacher was Kyogen. So the only other story I found about the historical Kyogen who this koan involves is he was the person who said that somebody asked him, he thought he was enlightened. Somebody asked him what his original face looked like before he was born. And he went into a whole spiritual crisis and had to go work in a cemetery, re-examine his whole life to try to figure out to get back to the point where he thought he was, because he's just overthinking these things, which I can relate to. And I think that is a valuable piece of information to have as you hear this. The man was a big overthinker. The man who's telling the story was a big overthinker, and that threw his whole reality into question. So this is called Kyogen Mounts the Tree, but this is Kyogen telling the story about a man mounting a tree. So it says, Kyogen said, Zen is like a man hanging in a tree by his teeth over a precipice. His hands grasp no branch, his feet rest on no limb. And under the tree, another person asks him, why did Bodhidharma come to China from India? If the man in the tree does not answer, he fails. And if he does not answer, he falls and loses his life. Now what shall he do? And there's some more commentary on that. And there's a lot to unpack here, and we're not going to go over it all. But when I read that, I think of like the old Wile E. Coyote and Roadrunner cartoons. Like Wile E. Coyote was always out to get the Roadrunner, but and he would set up these elaborate traps for him. But then the Roadrunner would turn the traps around on the coyote. And he'd be there hanging from a tree by his teeth or something, and then Roadrunner would be like, meep, meep, and take off. And like the coyote would be destroyed by his own trap. So nobody put this monk in this tree. He put himself on that branch and he decided to bite down on it. Nobody forced him up there. It says Zen is like a man hanging in a tree. Like, not Zen is like a man who was forced to hang from a tree by his teeth. I relate to this guy, this monk that's hanging from the tree. You guys on Sunday in the Dirt Zendo, we're talking about TMJ. I have that too. Like, it's this thing where you like clamp down your jaw all the time. I'm always clenching my jaw, and it gives me migraines. The triggers for clenching my jaw are stress and fear and cold. And I'm a rock climber, so I'm always cold and stressed out and afraid. So I always have headaches. And today I had a migraine too. And I'll give you one guess as to why I'm afraid and anxious today. So I'm medicated a little bit today too. But this is, to me, is what I feel every time I bump up against one of these precepts. My jaw clenches. It's like I'm biting down on this metaphorical branch. And like nobody, when have you ever seen a tree that just has one branch that's as wide as a person's mouth? This tree is covered in branches. All he has to do is reach up and grab another branch. But we forget that there are multiple solutions to every problem we encounter. So here's an example. So my wife and I are always arguing about the snails in our garden. She wants to kill them. I want to follow the first precept. So sometimes she'll sneak poison out there without me knowing, but then I'll find all these dead snails and like we'll get into these arguments. And I'll be clenching my jaw the whole time, as if I'm biting down on this branch, without another way to go. And like what we do when we encounter these precepts, I think, is we think there's only two ways to go, right or wrong. We live in, because we're working with these precepts, we think we can either break the precept or follow the precept, but there's so many more options. There's branches everywhere for us to grab onto. There's branches for us to step onto. We can get ourselves off that tree and back onto into a safe space by just thinking a little bit longer, by taking the time. There's no rush. These snails are going to die one way or the other. Some of them survived longer because we've had these arguments, my wife and I, and some of them will survive and live a long, healthy, however long a snail lives because of those arguments. And some of them won't because I didn't argue hard enough or something. But the point is, like, there's no one right answer. There's no one wrong answer. And there's no one middle way. And there's also no rush. So if we break a precept, if we find ourselves just at a point where we're stuck and we can't figure out what to do because we've bumped up against this precept, there's a Dharma gate. There's a chance to honor the 10th precept. Maybe we have to, maybe we accidentally break the fourth precept. I don't remember which one that is, because we're too busy caught up in the 10th precept trying to honor this Dharma gate, but at least it's a Dharma gate. And the next time we encounter the fourth precept, we'll be that much more prepared to deal with it appropriately. And again, like we're not in control anyway. And we're not doing this for ourselves anyway. So when we break the precepts, it's not something for us to take hard, to be hard on ourselves about. It's just an opportunity to do better, to try harder, and to be there the next time, to be present the next time you find yourself in that situation, and to consider all the branches and not just the one you're biting. I have another example of this. I'm gonna turn off my camera because I thought this would be the easiest way to show you a picture. But Domio has this analogy. Hopefully you can see that. If you can't, it's a frog that's staring up at a butterfly. So Domio has this analogy of of shikantaza beings akin to a frog waiting for a fly. You're fully alert, but you're as still as possible. So I like this picture for that reason, because it reminds me of Zazen. But this frog seems to have a dilemma here. Like he has to choose, like, is he going to eat that butterfly or not? Like a fly, like, all right, he's a frog. It's his nature to eat a fly. He needs to eat something. But now there's this beautiful butterfly, this colorful butterfly that's like living art. And he's hungry and he has to decide, or she has to decide if they're going to eat that butterfly or not, or wait for the next fly to come along and let this creature live to honor that first precept. And you know what, like something else is going to fly by. Like he's, the time he spends trying to figure that out, the butterfly is going to fly away, but something else is going to show up. And that's my only point to show that picture. Sorry, I turned my mic off instead of my camera on. I just really like that picture, and I thought that's another illustration of, or something like something that I think about when I'm bumping up against the precepts. A fly will come along later. We've got 10 minutes, so I'm going to skip to the end. So I just have this thing I'm going to read word for word. It says, why take chukai? Why commit to the precepts? We do this because we each take the bodhisattva vow multiple times per week. All right, so I'm going off the script already. I don't know if you take it multiple times a week. I thought you all did it on Tuesday nights, but you didn't. We do it on Sundays. I do it every morning before I sit zazen. But I'm sure some of you have taken the bodhisattva, all of you have taken the bodhisattva vow at least once. And that's why we follow the precepts, because we have bodhicitta, because we want to go down the mountain, because something in us, inside of us, drives us to go down the mountain. We're not doing this for us or our own personal growth. We're doing it to free the numberless beings. Only Buddhas with other Buddhas can realize the truth of all things. If we're going to take that vow to treasure if we're going to take that vow to the treasures of Buddha, Dharma, and Sangha, then we are defaming those treasures if we don't, at the very least, keep these precepts in our thoughts and minds. The 10th precept is reminding us of the Bodhisattva vow. Beings are numberless. I vow to free them. Delusions are inexhaustible. I vow to end them. Dharma gates are boundless. I vow to enter them. The Buddha way is unsurpassable. I vow to embody it. It's reminding us of the whole purpose of taking Jukai. If we defame the three treasures, we're intentionally breaking every part of the Bodhisattva vow. And if we're doing that, then we have to ask ourselves, why are we practicing in the first place? That's all I have. I was hoping we could take the next 8 minutes at least for anyone who's taking Jukai to ask questions of the group, or anyone who's already taken Jukai to give advice to those 14 folks who are about to do so. Or if you have questions or comments or anything to add. Jinmyo.
Thank you very much, Greg. I love the way you think, and I'm very inspired by the way you think and by the way you've approached this talk. I really love the G.U. Kennett passage. I studied that myself when I presented this precept a couple of years back. And I'm like you in that her commentary about the Lord, it sounds so harsh and so heavily Christian from my own background. I don't know how I do it, but I just drop it. I just let it go and just continue with the rest of what she's saying. And it's a very inspiring short passage. So if anybody has a chance to see that or read it, it's the Kyoju Kaimon as done at Shasta Abbey that she wrote. The particular part that I love, and I add my own little word to it, when she says, do not criticize one another. Don't even bring it into question. Just accept it. It's just the way it is. And I've always loved that. So now I found somebody else who was very impressed by that too. It makes me feel good. Anyway, it was a wonderful talk. If you are interested in this path, if you have any interest in the path whatsoever, I encourage the taking of Jukai. You have nothing to lose. You have absolutely nothing to lose and everything to gain. And you're not going to get it all in one ceremony anyway. It's days and weeks and years of practicing in the most basic sense of that word. So, you know, take it Jukai, to use one of your phrases, Greg, it's a Dharma gate. It's just a way to get in. And for me, that is in fact what it felt like. It was a way to get in with all the other people who were serious about this path. So that's why I did it. And I'm so glad I did. I have never regretted. I have never thought that I did it too soon. And the wonderful thing about Jukai, it is probably my most favorite ceremony of the year, is that we all do it together again. We all say them again. So it's like everybody's taking Jukai. Thanks again for a wonderful talk.
Greg, what a beautiful talk. For being as scared as you were, it was just beautiful. Thank you so much. I'm tearing up. I don't know why. You know, I love what you said about Marjorie Taylor Greene, and I'm going to think about hugging her instead of punching her in the face, because that's really what I want to do. So I think I need to rethink that. I just want to say thank you. I'm very excited about Jukai, and this is such a wonder. I've been here, I think, a year now, because I think I started Broadway Zen at the end of the precepts last year, and it's just been such a wonderful experience and knowing everybody. So I'm really excited to be part of this sangha. But I really just wanted to say what a beautiful talk, and thank you.
Okay, yeah, go ahead, Betty.
Thanks, Greg. Can you hear me okay?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I echo what others have said. It's just really been an inspirational talk, and I have a couple of questions. I'm not taking Jukai, so I don't want to take time away from other people that need to speak, but one of the things that I really wanted to thank you for was what you said about when you do your vows to the image on your wall, and what that means to you, how you humble yourself as you bow to this image, which allows you or reminds you to humble yourself with others. And that's, I think that's really beautiful. And it's important to me because I have challenges with rituals in religion. So that really resonated with me, and I think I can wrap my that. So thanks for that. The other question I have is for you, and others have some reluctance to take Jukai for a number of reasons, all the reasons that other people have. But you said that, you know, when you first started the talk, that you said that you felt like taking the precepts and taking Jukai last year was really worthwhile, and that this year has been really different for you. And I was just curious, if you don't mind sharing, what's different? What, like, mechanically, is it been the honoring the three treasures? Is that the difference for you? The practice, a change of practice?
Well, to give some background, I think I'll put this in the context. I took Jukai at Shasta Abbey and then renewed my vows with Brightway about a week later. And to prepare for that, I did a lot of things through Brightway, through Shasta, but also on my own. I practiced one of the precepts every month. So if you condense taking refuge in the three treasures and the three pure precepts into 1 month each, then you've got 12 months, a full year, to really focus on one of each of the grave precepts, and then a month each for the pure precepts and the three refuges. So I was like pretty heavily focused on the precepts for 1 year, and I felt like I was just studying and like doing my homework. I felt like I was reading and like trying to pay attention to the world, but I didn't feel like I was incorporating it, what I was learning, into my life at all. I felt like I was learning the precepts rather than living the precepts, perhaps. But after I took Jukai and I made that vow to follow these precepts, that put them on a pedestal for me. Like you were saying, I didn't really love these forms when I first started practicing Zen. They just reminded me of some things that I really didn't agree with in my youth with the Catholic Church, and it just was very uncomfortable for me. But there's something about vows that puts things on a pedestal that makes them different. I think I've had another year of meditation going along with them, and so because of that, there's a certain amount of patience that I experience when I do find myself hanging on the tree by my teeth. So there's, like, I can't speak to your experience exactly. I know you've been sitting longer than I have, so maybe you do experience things the way that I have the last year from that. I definitely think another year of Zazen has definitely been a big part of why this year has been better, but that's what the Zazen is for me, is to set the stage for me to recognize when I'm bumping up against a precept, to take a beat, to figure out what to do next, and to just let that happen, to let that intuition shine through, I guess, to recognize when I need to give over myself to my intuition. So I think it's a combination of Zazen and Tao for me that are different this year than the previous year, where I was just reading books about the precepts and fighting with my wife about snails.
Thanks, Greg, that's awesome. And thanks for the great talk too, really appreciate it.
You're welcome. We're a minute over. I don't wanna take up everybody's night. So I don't have this memorized, so I'm gonna read that thing that Tomio does at the end. Abiding in this ephemeral world, like a lotus in muddy water, the mind is pure and goes beyond. Thus we bow to Buddha. All Buddhas throughout
space and time,
all honor, Bodhisattvas, Mahasattvas, wisdom beyond wisdom, Maha, Prajna, Paramita. Have a good night.
Thank you, Greg. It was wonderful.
Congratulations.
Bye, everybody.